All right, welcome back to the Crimson Flag Podcast, where we bring you a class-conscious analysis of historic and current events which are pertinent to the international working class movement. My name is FBK, and we're joined by Danky Kang here today. How's it going today, Danky?
Not too bad. I'm doing good.
There you have it. And this is the long-awaited second edition, the second episode of our Moscow Trials series. And, you know, to put this in, to maybe brand this a little better, we decided to call this series Understanding the Moscow Trials, because if you haven't seen this series yet, we are basically starting back a lot earlier than the 1930s. Our first episode was the early 1900s to about like the end of the 19. It was like about 1919. And so we're kicking off with about the end of the Russian Civil War. And that's where this episode will begin today.
So just to give viewers a recap, on the last episode, we talked about the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, the very earliest iteration of what would later become the Bolshevik Party. We talked about the Bolshevik-Menshevik split. We talked about the bourgeois revolution, followed by the Bolshevik Revolution. We talked about the leading up to the Russian Civil War and how that affected the economy and the revolution.
Right. Yeah, and we definitely focused a lot on the factional divisions and such, which, you know, that is our main emphasis, because we're talking about the history here, but we don't expect that we're going to give you all the history, because we're putting an emphasis on, like I said, the factional divisions that sprouted up during this time, because, like I said, the Moscow Trials will be one of the defining moments where the country decides how to handle these type of incidents. So in 1921, the Soviet government brought the Russian Civil War to its conclusion. This victory would come at a huge cost to industrial and agricultural production. At the end of the war, agricultural output was one half the pre-war output, whereas industry was at one seventh of the pre-war output level. This, coupled with the fact that a famine had broke out in several regions, meant that questions of development during peace times would not be without significant challenges. Furthermore, it became clear that the newly established Soviet government would remain the sole center of workers' power for the time being. Lenin had predicted that the imperialist war had the potential to spawn workers' revolutions throughout Europe. He was correct in the sense that the end of World War I resulted in the birth of the Soviet government, as well as revolutionary attempts in Europe. However, it wouldn't be until World War II that an imperialist world war would result in the birth of a handful of successful socialist revolutions. The way in which the Communist Party moved forward in the decade of 1920s was largely shaped by factors related to this internal and external reality. Debates and groupings of party members regularly birthed opposition factions within the party. Our study will emphasize the various methods used by the oppositional factions in the CP to influence policy and the effect it had on the party and the way in which the party dealt with the oppositionists. As episode one left off with the Civil War, this episode will begin near the end of that war. And we'll start off and we'll talk about war communism a little bit.
Right. I felt like it would be good at this point to really stress just how disheveled and destroyed the Soviet Union was at this time. They had just gone through World War I. They had just gone through two revolutions and a civil war. So the country was in absolute shambles. The industrial sector and the agricultural sector of the economy was completely destroyed. And so really what you have here at 1921 is you have this need for the Bolsheviks to right the ship and to get their country back up and running. So you'll see with their implementation of war communism, a sign of desperation from the Soviet government that we have to take drastic measures to preserve the revolution and to preserve our country.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I was looking at this the other day. It was a chart. It was like the cost of revolutions. And it was listing like the revolutions that resulted in the most deaths. And of course, when we talk about the Russian Revolution, we got to include the Civil War, because that was really what consolidated it. and it's up there as one of the highest. I believe it, like, it's estimated like 6 million to 9 million deaths or something around there. So it was pretty extreme what they were going through. And their implementation of war communism was definitely, you know, showing that. So in June 1918, the Bolsheviks began using a system of grain surplus appropriation, which later became known as war communism. The idea was that a fixed amount of grain from the peasantry would be used to maintain the armies and towns. Under the economic system of war communism, we see the nationalization of available industry, the forbidding of strikes and strict control of labor, requisition of agricultural surplus to a centralized government for redistribution, rationing of food, and the military control of certain labor forces. We call it war communism now, but at the time the Bolsheviks referred to it as surplus grain extraction and the militarization of labor. The former was the main feature of securing grain surplus in the Civil War, whereas the latter, the militarization of labor, began to be introduced near the end of that war. So yeah, so to talk a little bit about the militarization of labor, this meant the creation of industrial labor armies who would be subject to military-style discipline and repositioning. Trotsky's thesis titled On Mobilizing the Industrial Proletariat, On Labor Service, On Militarizing the Economy, and the Utilization of Army Units for Economic Needs was passed at the Ninth Party Congress in March of 1920. And here's a quote from that. It says, "The instrument of state compulsion is the state's armed force, consequently an element of the militarization of labor, to some extent and in form, is inevitably inherent in the transitional economy based on universal labor service," unquote. And another part he says, quote, "The entire population of the town and country must understand that the elimination of every kind of desertion of work, every sort of self-seeking, unpunctual attendance at work, carelessness, idleness, and abuse is a matter of life and death for the whole country, and must be achieved in the shortest time possible, even if this requires very harsh measures," unquote. I just want to say that, you know, the majority of party, including Lenin, they did vote for Trotsky's theses here at the Ninth Party Congress. So at the time, the Civil War, it was still in effect, and there was key industries that needed rapid mobilization. So like I said, Trotsky and Stalin were actually voting, you know, for these measures at the time. But you had a point there, Danke?
Yeah, so later on, we'll see Trotsky really overemphasizes the bureaucratization of this war communist policy. And strangely enough, Trotsky, who would later go on to rant about the red bureaucracy and the degenerated worker state that Stalin created, supposedly, you know, here he is advocating for the creation of a red bureaucracy, a true red bureaucracy. And Lenin and co. only really supported war communism insofar as the country was in very dire circumstances and it was out of complete necessity. But you'll see how Trotsky clings to this idea of war communism and essentially wants it to be the indefinite policy of the USSR.
Right. Yeah. We'll definitely get to that a little bit later. But yeah, like you said, as we'll see, you know, Lenin, he's viewing this as more flexible, like the times call for this, whereas Trotsky and others were viewing it as this is what any dictatorship of the proletariat would do kind of thing. So next we're going to talk a little bit about the railroad crisis, just to give a little bit more of the historical context. And then we'll talk a little bit about the opposition groups. So yeah, in 1920, the state of the railroads were an absolute crisis. Railroad construction would be critical for food distribution and economic stimulation. Over the summer of that year, Trotsky had a chance to put the militarization of labor into practice for the construction of railroads. Lenin's support for this can be seen in a letter from himself to Trotsky made in February of 1920, where he says, quote, "The situation with regard to railroad transport is quite catastrophic. Grain supplies no longer get through. Genuine emergency measures are required to save the position," unquote. So in August of 1920, the railroad and water transportation central bodies were merged into a joint central transport committee, And Trotsky was appointed People's Commissariat of Transport Communication. And in August of 1920, the Central Committee gave its support for these measures, and Lenin and Stalin, they did vote for its approval as well. So before we get to Lenin and Trotsky's split, which will be a second, or really, this would actually be the third split between Lenin and Trotsky. But did you have anything you wanted to say, Comrade Denke, before we move on?
Right. So I think the Soviet Union gets a lot of flack during this time period for the self-admitted drastic measures that they had to take, the harsh measures that they had to take to keep the Soviet economy afloat. And a lot of people will look to these measures and they'll, in isolation, like in a vacuum, and they'll say, oh, the USSR is some kind of red fascist bureaucracy. It's a degenerated worker state, that kind of thing. But you also have to keep in mind that the USSR was under extreme circumstances, and the same can be said for all of these communist countries. You know, it's very easy for us as Western leftists to sit back and criticize this revolution or that revolution, this communist party or that communist party. But when you look at what these parties were doing in the context of their material circumstances and the historical paradigm that was there at the time, all of these things make sense. Temporarily, you know, acquisitioning grain from the peasantry was a wartime measure that was necessary to ensure the survival of the revolution and to prevent the restoration of Tsarist power. But at the same time, advocating that this should be the indefinite policy of the Soviet Union really is an advocation for the creation of this sort of red bureaucracy. So funnily enough, we see Trotsky being the person who is really at the helm of promoting this war communist policy. And he would later become the one who would go on speaking tours all around the West, basically ranting about Stalinist red bureaucracy. And so the hypocrisy of Trotsky is evident for pretty much anybody to see.
Yeah, and of course this is a huge debate, and Trotsky does in his books try and like refute these. And so, you know, anybody sympathetic to Trotsky, they'll have their arguments against that for sure. But hopefully, you know, as we move on, we'll see some of why that is absolutely true, what you said. So yeah, on Lenin and Trotsky's split, so a party meeting of delegates to the All-Russian Trade Union Conference took place in November of 1920. It was here that Trotsky crossed the line with Lenin that would turn them at odds with each other once again. At the meeting, Trotsky said, quote, "We have built and rebuilt Soviet state economic organs, smashed them, and then rebuilt them once again, carefully selecting and checking the various workers in their various posts. It is quite obvious that it is necessary now to set about the reorganization of the unions. That is to say, first of all, to pick the directing personnel of the unions," unquote. The quote accurately portrays Trotsky's position at the time when war communism was clearly causing issues more than it was solving them. To be clear, Trotsky did recognize that war communism was causing issues. His solution, however, was to go further with the idea of war communism and to, quote, "tighten the screws," unquote, as he said. This would entail furthering the militarization of labor and subjecting the trade unions to similar measures. Lenin, however, was moving in the complete opposite direction at the time. There are two key issues of debate that were brought to the surface between Trotsky and Lenin. The first was their difference on the opinion on the militarization of labor, and the second was on the trade unions in the era of socialism. So first, the question of the militarization of labor. Up until now, we've explained that Lenin was clearly in support of Trotsky's views on this question, enough so that he voted for their approval at the Ninth Party Congress. The difference of opinion lies in the fact that Lenin made it clear that the economic system of surplus extraction that was war communism was necessary under the conditions of a civil war. Trotsky, on the other hand, seemed to have believed that these measures were still vital for socialist development and needed to continue. So Trotskyist Tony Cliff does admit that there is a clear difference between Lenin and Trotsky's views on the militarization of labor. He says in his book, it's called, quote, Trotsky, The Sword of the Revolution, 1917 to 1923, he says, quote, "There was a difference between Trotsky's attitude to the question of the militarization of labor and to that of Lenin's. Trotsky attempted to theorize and generalize the idea, whereas Lenin merely thought it necessary in the circumstances," unquote. At the 10th Party Congress, Lenin expressed his views on the matter when he said, quote, "The confiscation of surpluses from the peasants was a measure which were saddled by the imperative conditions of wartime," unquote. On the other hand, we see the views of Bukharin, who was siding with Trotsky at the time, here when he says, quote, "We conceive war communism to be the universal, that is to say, normal form of economic policy, the victorious proletariat, and not as being related to the war, that is, conforming to a definite state of civil war," unquote. We see that Lenin is describing war communism as a necessary evil, which is justified under the material conditions, while Bukharin and Trotsky, they were viewing it as the next rational step after workers' revolution.
Right. So there's several observations that I have here. But first of all, like, the biggest observation I have so far is Lenin is being a pragmatist when he's adopting war communist policies, but he doesn't cling to it like it's some kind of dogma, and that it's, you know, he doesn't cling to it like it's going to be the crux by which the revolution is won. In fact, you know, Lenin would later on say, yeah, we made some mistakes and we needed to address those mistakes. And so oftentimes in these political circumstances, in these revolutionary scenarios, walking the middle ground, the tightrope between ultra leftism on one side and revisionism on the other, is absolutely necessary for any communist party. We've seen throughout history, communist parties will stumble. Some of them will pick themselves back up, and others will stumble completely into either ultra leftism or revisionism. We can see the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in the Gorbachev era stumbled into revisionism, stumbled into, you know, ultimately what led to the dissolution of the USSR. We can see in other countries like in Cambodia, Democratic Kampuchea, that, you know, the Khmer Rouge went down a completely different road. They went down an ultra leftist road that wound up, you know, being equally as disastrous for, you know, the Cambodian communist movement. And so, you know, not to go too far off topic, but this is all to say that debate is critical. Self-criticism is critical in a communist party, and there will not be a single universal approach taken that will be successful in every possible circumstance. Of course, the approach that a communist party takes is dependent on their material conditions. As dialectical materialists, we can't prescribe a universal approach and a universal cure to every revolutionary or pre-revolutionary scenario.
Right. And it shows how quick that can change because, you know, I mean, 2-3 years, war communism was a beneficial policy, and then quickly it was not. So it shows that, yeah, you shouldn't universalize certain aspects of revolutions, and that really needs to be kind of fleshed out. But yeah, I think those are all solid points. But let's see. We'll also note that during their split, Lenin began speaking in somewhat regretful terms about the party's implementation of war communism. Taking the principle of self-criticism to heart, Lenin said in 1921, quote, "In this respect," meaning the implementation of war communism, "we are very much to blame for having gone too far. We overdid the nationalization of industry and trade, clamping down on local exchange of commodities. Was that a mistake? It certainly was," unquote. He went on to say, quote, "In this respect, we have made many patent mistakes, and it would be a great crime not to see it, and not to realize that we have failed to keep within bounds and have not known where to stop. There has, of course, also been the factor of necessity. Until now, we have been living in the conditions of a savage war that imposed an unprecedented burden on us and left us with no choice but to take wartime measures in the economic sphere as well," unquote. Thus we see in regard to war communism, Lenin took the path of stressing persuasion, where, and that was his exact wording. You notice in his speeches, he starts saying persuasion a lot. Where Trotsky, he argued for quote unquote tightening the screws, as he called it. So next we're going to go on to the 10th Party Congress and the trade union debate. And we're going to finish up with that. Did you want to make any final points about all of that there, though, Danky?
Yeah, I mean, at any point during a Communist Party's formation of policy, there needs to be a certain level of mass connection, of mass input. And for Trotsky to have this idea that, like, war communism should be the modus operandi of the USSR, completely ignores the immediate material needs of the peasants, which were promised by the Bolsheviks peace, land, and bread. It's hard to have bread when it's all being confiscated. All your grains are being confiscated. It's hard to have peace when Trotsky's wanting permanent revolution. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But it's also impossible to, you know, have land when there is a civil war going on and the White Army is ravaging the entire countryside. So, you know, all of these measures taken to implement war communism, this was rightly viewed by Lenin as a temporary wartime measure, literally a necessary evil, whereas Trotsky was framing this as being the end-all be-all of socialist revolution. And Bukharin was too. It's not like Trotsky was alone in this. There was, you know, this whole faction of people who essentially fetishized the party bureaucracy, placed more faith in the party elite than in the masses. And there are certain circumstances where you have to, you know, trust and prioritize the tactics of the party elite. But then there's other times where you have to take into consideration where the masses are, and to abandon the mass line, which I would argue that Trotsky's doing in promoting war communism. You know, he is essentially abandoning the workers that he's claiming to try to liberate.
Yeah, and that's basically it. And, you know, you mentioned permanent revolution and his stance on the peasants. We're going to get on the next episode. That's definitely going to be like a more ideological centered episode, because we got to address it. You know, I was debating if we should, but if we're talking about this, we got to talk about the ideological side of what Trotsky was advocating for. But that's going to come next episode when we're talking about socialism in one country and all that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So just one last observation I had, and this is related to permanent revolution. But I mean, I wonder how much of Trotsky's insistence on war communism was really to promote permanent revolution abroad. Because, I don't know, to me, it's easy to see how if the labor in the Soviet Union was militarized in this way, if the entire economy was geared towards sponsoring revolutions abroad, war communism would be the way to do it. Because after all, why would you want to build up the material conditions in the Soviet Union when you can just export it all abroad and have a revolution in Germany or in France or in Britain? So, yeah. I mean, it's just food for thought. But I mean, we can sort of see in his insistence of war communism, you know, a justification almost for permanent revolution.
Yeah, and I think you're picking up on the criticisms, you know, even before we're saying of, I know you're familiar with some of these criticisms, of course, but, you know, that's what people say. Trotsky didn't trust the peasants. He wanted to just export revolution, didn't care about the people of, you know, Soviet Union. But, you know, what we're showing and what we're talking about, hopefully, is kind of, you know, bringing out those arguments. But now we're going to talk about the 10th Party Congress and the trade union debate, as it's called. And this is going to finish off this little section here of like the party history before we go to the next big oppositional movement. So this all came to a head at the 10th Party Congress of 1921. It was significant for a number of reasons. The Congress would adopt Lenin's policy towards the trade unions, set rules regarding factionalism and unity, began taking serious steps towards allying with the peasantry, and made its first steps towards adopting the new economic policy. The worsening conditions in the country, coupled with the peasantry's dissatisfaction with war communism, led to numerous factions and debates. Thus, while Lenin and Trotsky were in the heat of a debate, many other contenders suddenly entered the ring. The discussion soon morphed into a debate over the role of the trade unions under socialism. Although Trotsky summed it up well 3 years later when he said, quote, "The discussion in no way revolved around the trade unions, nor even workers' democracy. What was expressed in these disputes was a profound uneasiness in the party, caused by the excessive prolonging of the economic regime of war communism. The entire economic organism of the country was in vice. The discussions on the role of the trade unions in a workers' democracy covered up the search for a new economic road," unquote. The varying views on the subject got so convoluted that 8 separate platforms were proposed in the party press during the lead-up to the 10th Party Congress of 1921. During the lead-up to the Congress, it is said that daily articles were being published in Pravda expressing the various views on the role of the trade unions. This is where some of Lenin's sharpest polemics against Trotsky make their appearance. It is also where Alexandra Kollontai publishes the pamphlet Workers' Opposition, introducing another major component into the trade union debate. Tony Cliff, in his previously mentioned book, writes, quote, "In the end, 3 platforms were presented to the Congress. On one side were Trotsky and Bukharin, and 6 other Russian names that I can't pronounce. And they were the 8 members of the Central Committee. On the other side was the Workers' Opposition, whose main leaders were Shlapnikov and Kollontai. In between was the platform of the 10, which was Lenin, Zinoviev, Tomsky, and several others, including Stalin. Thus it came down to 3 groups at the 10th Party Congress: the Trotsky-Bukharin group, the Workers' Opposition, and those representing the platform of the 10, Lenin's group. We'll briefly go through each of their positions. Do you want to read through these, Danky?
Yeah, so we'll start with the first group, the Trotsky-Bukharin group. So the Trotsky-Bukharin group held to the position that the militaristic method of organizing labor should be extended to the trade unions. Their view was that much of the economy was already being organized under military discipline, so the next logical step is to apply this method to the trade unions. The term this group used was the statification of trade unions. The other major feature was that they argued for the planned transformation of the unions into apparatuses of the worker state. And so that was the first group we were talking about, Trotsky-Bukharin's group, which wanted to incorporate trade unions under the state apparatus. Then you have the workers' opposition. They said, in substance, the policy of the workers' opposition advocated would be summed up in a single phrase: the unionization of the state. While Trotsky was arguing for the statification of the unions. So the workers' opposition's thesis is that the union should control the state. This was rebuked by Lenin and his supporters and framed as anarcho-syndicalist deviation. Now, anarcho-syndicalist holds that in a post-capitalist society, economic management will be under the control of trade unions. And for Lenin, that was too reminiscent of the workers' opposition's proposition. The fact that the Kronstadt mutiny was still in recent memory made this anarchist-like deviation more concerning for him as well. So before we talk about the platform of the 10, I really want to talk about like this debate about whether unions should control the state or the state should control the unions. And I feel like Lenin came up with a good middle ground for this solution, which is, as we'll learn, is to essentially treat the unions as a transmission belt organization for the party. But no one really had a clear view. It's like, this is how it works, this is how it should be, et cetera, et cetera. So there were a bunch of different approaches, there were a bunch of different arguments. But Lenin's concern is that state power would fall into the hands of these isolated trade unions who would start to act in with their own self-interest at the expense of the national economy. That's the biggest argument against anarcho-syndicalism, is that essentially these trade unions will over time begin to operate almost as bourgeois power structures. But let's see. So the third group, in this whole debate is the Platform of 10, and this is Lenin's group. Now, it was neither in favor of statification of the trade unions nor the unionization of the state. And like I said before, this represented what I feel like is a reasonable middle ground to this solution. So this is how the Platform of 10 described their view on the trade unions in the era of proletarian dictatorship. So they say the trade unions, which take in all industrial workers, are an organization of the ruling dominant governing class, which has now set up a dictatorship of the proletariat. It's exercising coercion through the state, but it is not a state organization, nor is it one designed for coercion, but for education. It's an organization designed to draw in and to train. It is, in fact, a school. Once again, keep in mind, he's talking about trade unions here. Trade unions, a school of administration, a school of economic management, a school of communism. We have here a complex arrangement of cogwheels, which cannot be be a simple one. For the dictatorship of the proletariat can't be exercised by a mass proletarian organization. It can't work without a number of transmission belts running from the vanguard party to the mass of the advanced class, and from the latter to the mass of the working people. So we can see here from this that Lenin simply believed that the trade union shouldn't be a direct component of the government. Instead, he proposed that trade unions are, number one, a sort of school that trains workers on how to organize, and number two, that they should function as a transmission belt. This concept is almost similar to Mao's idea of the mass line. The idea of a transmission belt, however, puts focus on how mass organizations of workers can serve as a link between the party and the masses. So that for a lot of our viewers, that might come across as just being complete gobbledygook. They may not understand what we're talking about here. But in short, what we're talking about is, should trade unions be controlled by the state? Or should trade unions call the shots? We can see Lenin's approach is that the trade unions need to serve a role in educating the working class and engaging and radicalizing the working class. This cannot be done with the introduction of bourgeois trade unions. And so, you know, for all of these, you know, quote unquote, Marxist socialists going around nowadays saying like trade unions should control everything, or anarcho-syndicalists saying trade unions should control everything. I mean, of course, the caveat is that these have to be socialist trade unions. These can't be bourgeois trade unions calling the shots, because otherwise you would have a restoration of czarist power.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. I mean, that pretty much sums up, you know, the debate that was going on and the implications of, I mean, imagine if it would have gone either way, how destructive it could have been for the Soviet government at the time if they took like a rightist point of view or an ultra leftist point of view, you know. So it shows how part of why they were successful, I believe, you know, we talk about why did it work out. We might see other socialist governments not reach that level, or maybe not even last near as long. In that initial time, we're very lucky that they had a strong, they were really following like what we would now call the Leninist line. They were voting along it very strongly in those initial decades. And I'm going to quote from Tony Cliff's book here. He says, at the 10th Congress itself, Lenin's motion was accepted by an overwhelming majority. 336-4 against 50 for Trotsky's motion, and only 18 for the workers' opposition. So, you know, I talk about all that. We talk about all this, and it's like, no matter what happened, you know, Lenin's position still like overwhelmingly won. And, you know, just to sum it up basically about all this, I mean, that's basically what happened at the 10th Party Congress. You know, these that opposition music movement in particular, the workers' opposition, they were overwhelmingly just crushed, as well as Trotsky's positions. So, yeah, just to finish off briefly here, there's two more things I want to talk about the 10th Party Congress before we go on. At the 10th Party Congress, they also started talking about the new economic policy. So first on the NEP, It was a limited and temporary freedom of trade that was intended to stimulate the economy and raise production to its pre-war levels. These first steps were taken when the Congress voted in favor of Lenin's suggested tax in kind, and the overall policy would be adopted later. So let's just briefly talk about the NEP before we go on. Would you like to just sum up briefly the NEP, Comrade Danke?
Right. So the NEP, the Soviet Union looked around and said, look, our country is underdeveloped. We don't have any industry. And so we need to encourage capital investment in limited sectors of the economy. And so, for example, railroad companies, the Soviet Union needed railroads constructed. And it became abundantly clear to people who weren't part of this Trotskyist faction that literally enslaving the workers and forcing them to build railroads was not the correct way to go about it. And so what they did is introduce brief market reforms and state capitalism in a certain sectors of the economy. And we can see here that the NEP course corrected a lot of the missteps made with the implementation of war communism, but it also created problems as well. It created an entire class of people called the NEP men. And so when we talk about the new economic policy, really, I like to talk about it as a product of its time, as a product of the conditions of the USSR in that specific time period. And it should not be looked at as an indefinite solution to how to build socialism. It shouldn't be looked at as like a universal problem-solving method, that the NEP was largely a response to the dire circumstances and technological and industrial backwardness of the USSR at that time.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a fair point. And as you said, you know, well, I think, you know, a lot of it is considering Russia's conditions at the time. I mean, because it was a backwards country, economically speaking, you know, they didn't go through that stage of capitalism. So it was necessary for such a, you know, state orientated, like capitalist, you know, way of production to kind of be created. Because, I mean, you can imagine the peasants, they're starving and everything. And at times it'd be simpler just to trade your excess grain, stuff like that. So until socialist economy develops, you know, it is almost self-defeating to say you can't trade or anything like that. If you don't have the like industrial capacity to do socialist industry, you know, to say there shouldn't be like private property or private trading, it could be a dangerous situation, which they started to see.
And of course, like, let's not kid ourselves with thinking that like this means we should just completely open up the economy and do perestroika and glasnost, because that's not at all what we're saying here. There are certain sectors of the economy which don't necessarily have to be controlled by the state right off the bat. And, you know, these sectors of the economy were the ones that were going to be the most difficult to improve under war communism. They were literally going to have to, you know, forcefully recruit workers and put them to work against their will. And so, you know, on one hand, if you didn't implement the new economic policy, you would probably be dealing with forced labor. But on the other hand, if you overemphasize the sort of strategies that led to the new economic policy, you lead towards revisionism and slowly restoring capitalism. And so I feel like there needs to be a balancing act. There needs to be a nuance in how we look at the NEP, that of course there were sectors of the economy that were still under Soviet control. They were under direct government control. And indeed, even the NEP men were under certain levels of control by the Communist Party. It's not like they were just allowed to ride roughshod and do whatever they want. It's certainly not that they were allowed to dominate local elections and take political power back. So that's another important distinguishment to make when talking about the new economic policy. At no point during the implementation of the new economic policy did you see a restoration of capitalist political power in the country.
And, right.
You know, when you did see begin to see that sort of manifestation, the NEP was ended. It was correctly ended by Stalin.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, not treating these things as universals. As we'll see later, you know, there was people who wanted to continue the NEP, basically, and even though the conditions weren't necessary for it anymore. So that's another example of that. But before we proceed, we should discuss the position of the party on factions, according to the 10th Party Congress in 1921. Because as this resolution, it will remain of importance regarding future factional disputes. At the Congress, Lenin made it clear that criticisms of party leadership is not the primary concern. In fact, he argued that one element of fighting factionalism is making sure that criticism of the party's decisions can be done as quickly and as efficiently as possible. To do this, he declared that proper channels for criticism will be made more accessible. He also argued that the leadership should take, quote, analyses of the party's general line, estimates of its practical experience, checkups on the fulfillment of its decisions, studies of the methods of rectifying errors, unquote. Banning factions itself couldn't be the only solution, but the leadership would have to go out of its way to gauge the feeling of party members and the masses. What we described above is Lenin's emphasis on the D in democratic centralism. This coin, however, has two sides, so the party did explicitly ban groups and factions. The concern was that without taking these measures against factional activity, that decisions of the Central Committee would not have to sit well with a unified party, but that their decisions would have to be analyzed by various factions, all with separate agendas, before a consensus could be reached. A declaration made at the Congress would help seal the fate for the oppositional groups that are to come. Lenin said, quote, "The Congress therefore hereby declares dissolved and orders the immediate dissolution of all groups without exception formed on the basis of one platform or another, such as the Workers' Opposition Group and the Democratic Centralism Group," which we didn't get to mention, unquote. So later, when we see individuals from these oppositions try to invoke the name of Lenin, we see that their outcry against banning of factions was not Stalin's invention, but it was Lenin's. So yeah, after this, we're going to talk about the purge of 1921. I don't know if you wanted to make anything, any comments to sum up the 10th Party Congress there, Comrade Danke.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because we can see there is a clear distinguishment made between what constitutes a factionalist group and what constitutes like debate within the party. And Lenin wanted to set it up to where there were avenues by which party members can address their grievances with leadership. And he also was keen to emphasize that leadership should have a connection with the masses. It should have a connection with everyone in the party. And so it shouldn't just be this elite, isolated clique of leaders who are, you know, controlling everything and running everything, that there needs to be a mass line involved. And it's interesting to see this getting brought up, because in our discussion about commandism in a communist party, we can see how going the other road and not allowing any sort of debate or discussion within the party can actually give rise to factions just as much, if not more so, than allowing debate. So I think that a party needs to take a stance on, here is a forum that members can address their grievances, they can state their opinions, but like democratic centralism says, as an organizing measure, like once a measure has been democratically approved by the party, it's binding to all members. And so for certain people to publish newsletters that are against the party line while still like serving as members of the CPSU, I feel like, yes, it would lead towards factionalism and it would lead towards these different bickering factions having vastly different interpretations as to how to go forward and how to implement policy. And that would ultimately lead towards the destruction of the party's effectiveness. If the party started splintering and splitting off into all these different groups and no single one really commanded political power, then ultimately that leaves the movement extremely weak, the revolution extremely weak, and it paves the way for capitalist restoration.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And it is interesting because, of course, bourgeois historians, they'll phrase it as the Bolsheviks largely leaned on the more authoritarian tactics. And, you know, as we're seeing, you know, it is a balance between centralization and democracy, as like the two words imply. All right. So, yeah, now we're going to talk about the party purges of 1921. So individuals involved in various factional groupings during the trade union debate gathered their strength and came out against the NEP from the left and the right. The official history of the Soviet Union refers to quote unquote unstable elements in the party as being the source of much of the factional work at the time. Regarding the makeup of these individuals, it describes semi-nationalists from the border regions who are not familiar with socialist ideology, let alone Marxism-Leninisms, as well as Mensheviks. It was becoming clear that factional groupings were costing the party valuable time and resources. As mentioned previously, the 10th Party Congress passed resolutions banning factional activity. And when the individuals involved resurrected their opposition, this time to the NEP, the Central Committee undertook its first official purge. In Lenin's article called Purging the Party, he says, quote, "To purge the party, it is very important to take the suggestions of non-party working people into consideration. It will produce big results. It will make the party a much stronger vanguard of the class than it was before," unquote. In the article, he goes on to stress the importance of having non-party affiliated worker participation in the purging of officials. The goal was to build a base of support amongst the workers and peasants. Lenin argued that purging overly bureaucratic officials would only resonate with the masses if their participation was a factor in the process. Other elements that were purged were party members with, quote, conduct unbecoming to communists, unquote, which usually meant that they were drinking too much and partying and such. By the end, a total of one-third of the party had been expelled or placed on probation, further strengthening the party's overall character. Yeah, so that was just a brief overview of the party purge of 1921. And this is something that they will do again. I believe up until the time of what we call the great purges of the 30s, they do some like semi purges in between. But this is the first time they do it. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, Danke.
Right. So I don't know. One thing that I've sort of noticed, and maybe this is right, maybe this is wrong, but it seems like during the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, during the time of the Russian Civil War, and the very earliest days of the USSR, it became almost a necessity to have alliances with these people who present petty bourgeois ideology or conduct unbecoming of communists. And this compromising and this working with other people to accomplish the immediate goal of revolution had a detriment to the party in that you had large portions of the Communist Party that weren't communists and they weren't sympathetic with the cause of communists. And like we just said, a lot of these people purported semi-nationalist sentiments. They wanted to split away from the USSR and have an independent country. And another factor that led into this was, I think after the Russian Civil War, the Communist Party could finally take a step back and breathe a little bit. And they said, all right, now it's time for us to clean house. When it talks about people, opportunists in the party attacking the party's new economic policy from the left and the right. From the left, specifically, they were trying to argue that the USSR was letting capitalism come back in. And to a certain extent, they were right. They were allowing capitalism to come back into the country, but in a very limited, controlled manner. And there was nothing, no part of the NEP, which led towards a restored capitalist class actually stealing political power. Political power still remained with the working class in the USSR.
It is kind of like, here's the thing about the new economic policy is it was largely shaped by Bukharin. And Bukharin, he was under the impression that the new economic policy was something that should continue. So he was attacking it from the right. You know, you were describing the left-wing critique of it. Bukharin later would have a right-wing critique of it that he would want it to continue longer. You also mentioned about during war communism, just the necessity of bringing other elements into the party who you normally wouldn't. And I think we mentioned in our first episode about that a little bit, how Trotsky, he was bringing in like czarist officers and such. And once again, that was a situation where Lenin and Stalin were voting that, you know, we should do this, but it started to get to be such a problem. They were like, we got to cut this off. But it was a similar situation in the party where they were letting elements in who they probably maybe wouldn't have if it wasn't under that situation. So that's what the purge was all about. They weren't violent. I want to stress for anybody that may not know that these purges, I mean, they may have included trials, but they were not like largely shaped by like, or they weren't defined by big trials or anything like that. So these were just, internal party things, getting rid of members, switching positions. I also want to briefly mention there was the Lenin enrollment at the time. You know, Lenin died and there was a lot more people studying communism who wanted to pretty much fill his position and they joined the party. So as the purge happened, you know, there was this influx of people who were getting into communism. So there was that dynamic as well with it.
During this time period where Lenin has passed away and it's unclear who is to assume the helm, I imagine this was quite a chaotic period in the USSR. You had lots of debates, lots of factions forming, lots of people who had ambitions about becoming the party leader or the general secretary. But there's also this notion, especially amongst the West, that whenever a party purge was committed, that it was the party leader basically consolidating power around himself and getting rid of anyone who would challenge him. And I feel like in our research, we've shown repeatedly that these purges weren't about getting rid of anyone who would challenge leadership. Rather, it's about getting rid of those people who would try to circumvent the democratic process and railroad their views into becoming official party policy. People like Trotsky, who wanted to continue war communism indefinitely, even though it was against the will of the overwhelming majority of workers in the Soviet Union. So, when all is said and done, these purges, if they didn't occur, they would have left the Communist Party weak. They would have left it fractured and unable to organize properly. And I think FVK pointed out that these purges weren't necessarily violent. Just because a person was purged from the party doesn't mean that they were taken and killed without a trial.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And yeah, just to continue on here, we're going to now talk about, I think I mentioned Lenin's death. I think I skipped ahead a little bit. We actually haven't gotten there yet. But next we're going to go on to the scissors crisis and the declaration of the 46 oppositionists. And so before we do that, we'll briefly go through the 11th and 12th party congresses before we reach the next factional opposition movement. At the 11th Party Congress in 1922, only a year after the implementation of the NEP, Lenin declared the party would begin its offensive on private capital. Although the NEP wouldn't officially end until 1928, excesses created by the market-oriented reform were being addressed by the state. And the 12th Party Congress in 1923 would mark Lenin's first important political absence due to his suddenly declining health. It was May of 1922 that Lenin suffered the first of three strokes, which would finally kill him in January of 1924. It wasn't until early 1923 that his health began seriously hindering his ability to engage in party work. In that year, we also see the emergence of an issue that would shape the next factional uprising in the party. This is what would later be called the Scissors Crisis. This was a situation where industrial prices were rising at a significantly faster rate than those of agriculture. In October of 1923, the industrial prices were at 276% of their 1913 level, whereas agriculture prices were only at 89%. This meant that the income of peasants decreased as manufactured goods rose in cost, leading them to resort to subsistence farming instead of engaging with the market within the confines of the NEP. One of the factors that led to this phenomenon was the rise of the NEP men, as those who were engaged in manufacturing or trading were pushing for the cost of overhead to be raised on production for the sake of artificially grinding out more profits. This situation was ultimately quelled in 1924 when the party largely stripped the NEP men of their influence, reduced the price of industrial manufacturing, and by further rationalizing production. However, while the crisis was a significant concern, a factional uprising shook the party. This factional episode began with everybody's favorite quote-unquote non-factional social democrat, as he used to refer to himself in his early revolutionary days. And that is, of course, Trotsky. It began when Trotsky sent a letter to the Central Committee. In this letter, Trotsky begins referring to the leadership as a regime that began to silently form prior to the 12th Party Congress. He complains of a system of appointment that he claims led to an over-bureaucratization in the party. It would have been clear for those in the upper echelons of the party that Lenin could be on his way out. The fact that the opposition has ramped up their attack on the party's leadership at this time shows they were likely opportunistically taking advantage of the situation. A week later, Trotsky's letter was followed by the Declaration of the 46. This was a document signed by 46 leaders within the party who echoed Trotsky's concern of inter-party democracy, although Trotsky doesn't seem to be directly involved in the declaration as far as we can see. The signatories prophesized that the party leadership's incompetency would lead to the destruction of Soviet power, a fate they claimed they wanted to avoid by allowing factional groupings more freedom within the party. The demands ran counter to the historic policy on factions that passed the 10th Party Congress. During this period of inter-party disunity, those who began to refer to themselves as Trotskyists began to capitalize on the situation. Trotsky would begin to refer to the students as, quote unquote, the truest barometer, meaning the students' attitude towards the party was the best meter for gauging the party's legitimacy. A sympathizer of Trotsky's would argue that he truly believed this, while his critics may argue that it was simply an attempt on Trotsky's part to gain a base of support amongst the students. Further, Trotskyists at the time began distributing oppositional documents within and outside of the party. The claim that party leadership has fostered a degeneration began to make its first appearance as an argument of the Trotskyists as well. Through their agitation, the Trotskyists effectively forced a discussion on the party. We should note here that in every oppositional event we've noted thus far, the Bolsheviks, no matter how untimely these debates came, welcomed the discussions and thoroughly allowed oppositionists to express their opinions in party newspapers, meetings, and congresses. As history shows, the debate on inter-party democracy was started by the party leadership itself in early 1923. The oppositionists hadn't made their presence felt until October of 1923.
So that's very interesting. I mean, already we can see that there is a differing of narratives here. Trotsky's narrative is that the Bolshevik party is brutally repressing any sort of opposition, that they're degenerating, that there's no democracy. But yet we can see that within the Bolshevik party, indeed, there's this push for an expansion of democracy, even a push for participation of the workers in these purges and other events. So we can see really that the party is opening up. It's not closing itself off. And as far as, you know, Trotsky wanting to have, you know, unchallenged factions within the party, we can see how that would be completely disastrous. And we can also see how that goes against the structure that the Bolshevik Party had already set up. It goes against democratic centralism. It goes against every sort of organizational principle the Communist Party had adopted up to this point. And so the Bolshevik Party had created avenues by which these oppositionists can state their grievances. And they didn't try to silence them because, you know, if they did, we wouldn't be reading about their opposition today. So, you know, all that is to say, I can see from this example and from previous examples we've talked about how the Bolshevik Party tried time and time again to just allow these opportunists and these oppositionists to state their business, to state their grievances. And it seems to me that Trotsky and all these other factions were just upset that the majority of the party agreed with, you know, Stalin and with Lenin.
So, I mean, one of the theories that some people put forward is that, you know, despite there being evidence of these avenues for expressing your certain like opposition to the party's decisions, you know, Trotsky was pushing for these things like outside of the party so he could really try and just build on people who already had grievances and, you know, try and position himself to be the leader. That's one of the theories, at least. But as far as that, I think we'll go into that definitely a little more in the next episode, as far as like his, you know, the power struggle, you know, and that whole thing. But, that was the, 11th and 12th party congresses. So now we're going to talk about the 13th party conference. And I had to look this up. I believe they do the conferences before the congresses to kind of get, you know, an idea of what they're going to do. So, yeah. And this is the last thing we're going to talk about here. This is so at the party's 13th Congress provided a significant stance against Trotskyism in January of 1924. Stalin summed up the discussion that was forced on the party and declared that Trotskyism was a petty bourgeois deviation. In his speech, Stalin describes how the Political Bureau and the Presidium of the CCC met and discussed a resolution on inter-party democracy, a question of concern to the oppositionists. In the meeting, a resolution was unanimously passed in regard to inter-party democracy. Literally, the very next day, Trotsky published his own personal resolution to inter-party democracy. Stalin, he then asked the party, can the masses submit to their discipline when their own party members, referring specifically to Trotsky, brazenly put forward their own personal agendas? Stalin goes on to question the true intentions of the oppositionists. He points out the hypocrisy of Trotsky's concerns over inter-party democracy when he was the one advocating to shake the trade unions up from above at the 10th Party Congress. Further, he notes that commissions had been set up to deal with the questions of inter-party democracy, the scissors crisis, and the transportation crisis. He points out that the oppositionists should have sent their letters to these commissions, as that would have been the most efficient and professional way of submitting their proposals. Instead, most of their agitation was focused on reaching outside of the party, making the atmosphere of debate even more intense. It is interesting. Like, I've been reading through all these documents and stuff, and the party like was really trying to stress that they aren't trying to silence criticism. And I mean, of course, they would decide to silence some criticism. And, you know, I mean, you could say that's unfair or whatever. But Stalin's point here is that, like, even if you have these concerns, there's a better way of doing it. And those avenues are readily available. So it's clear that they have ulterior motives, kind of thing. And, you know, this next part is really interesting because he eventually went further than that. So he went on to talk about how he personally engaged with Trotsky to resolve the issue. We'll now quote from Stalin's speech at the 13th Congress. This is Stalin. He says, quote, "I must state here, comrades, we took every measure to work in harmony with Trotsky. Although I must say that this proved anything but an easy task. We had two private conferences with Trotsky, went into all questions of economic and party matters, and arrived at certain views on which there were no disagreements. As I reported yesterday, a subcommission of three, which was composed of Stalin, Trotsky, and another Soviet official, was set up in continuation of these private conferences and of these efforts to ensure harmony in the work of the Political Bureau. This subcommission drew up the draft resolution, which subsequently became the CC and the CCC resolution on democracy, unquote. So imagine this, Stalin and Trotsky in the same room, literally working out their differences. So Stalin explained at the 13th Party Conference that at the time, he was under the impression that Trotsky's immediate concerns were addressed with the resolution that he and him personally worked on. Only a couple of days later, however, Trotsky sent another letter to the Central Committee, which opened new criticisms not mentioned before. Stalin expressed his frustration that these issues could have been addressed days prior when Trotsky was literally in the same room with him writing the resolution.
It's just hilarious to see, like, all right, the Bolshevik Party is trying their very best to listen to the grievances of these Trotskyites and to take them seriously. And Stalin even meets with Trotsky and they form a resolution that both of them agreed with at the time. And then Trotsky is still being butt mad. I mean, it's obvious to anybody who like researches this that Trotsky is just a little snake and he's not interested about actually resolving the problems in the party. He is truly like the worst sort of party member. He's a splitter. He's a wrecker. He's the kind that will come in and drive a wedge in the party where really there's none needed. He's starting issues that have already been addressed.
Yeah, I think that's a completely legitimate reaction. I mean, that seems to very much be the case. I almost want to it does raise the question, why didn't they kick him out sooner? Kind of thing. But yeah, that will eventually be, you know, next episode when we get to that point. But just to finish up here briefly, it was with this letter that the second phase of the opposition began. This is where Trotsky began speaking of the degeneration of cadres and leadership, the students as being the truest barometer and not the workers, and wanting to grant freedom for inter-party groups and factional activity. In the letter, he stated, quote, "I am especially alarmed by the purely formal attitude of the Political Bureau members on the question of groups and factional formations," unquote. So by the end of the 13th conference, the majority of delegates voted in favor of the characterization of the opposition as a petty bourgeois deviation. This was later adopted by the 13th Congress, and the delegates of the Communist International showed their support for the decision when they voted for it at their 5th Congress. Thus, we see another decisive win where the party, despite admitting certain mistakes and setbacks, triumphed over the oppositional groupings in the party and their various leaders. Yeah, so, there's definitely a lot in there, but, you know, one thing that I did want to mention, I do think it is interesting Trotsky's appeal to the students in saying that they are the truest barometer. And if by that, he means that, when we talk about like legitimacy in a society and like viewing a government as legitimate, you know, that's kind of like how you consolidate your revolution. And as communists, you would expect that we would say the workers are the truest barometer, you know, and in Russia, in their situation, the peasants and workers. But instead, Trotsky's here saying that it's the opinion of the students and the intellectuals who we need to really win over. And, you know, I mean, I guess I do wonder, you know, was this something he really believed as a Marxist? Or is this like just an appeal to students because they're normally the ones who are maybe a little more active to go out and protest, go out in the street, maybe distribute leaflets for you. I just wonder your reaction to that as well, Danky.
Yeah, Because I was wondering if he made this appeal to the students because the students represented that sort of petty bourgeois element. Because I'm sure that a lot of them were, you know, the sons and daughters of NEP men who, I mean, let's be real, they did earn profits during the brief period of the new economic policy, and they could probably afford to send their kids to fancy schwanky dank universities. And of course, they would write scathing critiques of, you know, the Soviet government and things along that those lines. And so Trotsky saw a natural ally, and he said, look, these students, they are semi-privileged, and so I'm just going to appeal to them as much as possible. And, you know, he probably presented it in a way like, oh, yeah, you're challenging the man. You know, you're the true blue communist revolutionaries. You're revolting against this degenerated worker state. But I don't know. Another weird thing that I noted in all of this is that it seems like time and time again, Trotsky would create a rift in the party, and Lenin and Stalin would come along and try to mend that rift, and then Trotsky would rip it open again. He would reintroduce old issues, and it's clear to me that, like, he had no interest in actually resolving conflicts within the party. He just wanted to create conflict. And we can see this really come to head in the next part, but I was wondering if you had anything to say about anything else to say about, like, his weird appeal to the students and stuff like that.
No, I don't really have a comment about all that. I think you're right, though. The last thing I really wanted to mention here was just his critique of the leadership being a regime that formed before the 12th Party Congress. This is his basis for saying that they're not a legitimate. I mean, he never said they're not socialists. He just described them as a degenerated worker state. And this is like the fundamental aspect of that critique. A lot of people will point out when you look at Trotsky's rhetoric as well, you got to question, you know, how much more democratic would he be if he was in leadership?
Exactly.
So, would all that kind of talk about, you know, democracy and stuff stay when it's him in power? I mean, we'll never know, of course, so I don't want to speculate too much.
So really, I wonder if Trotsky's critique boils down to like, oh, the party doesn't have a mass line. And we can see clearly how Lenin and Stalin after him are really emphasizing having a mass line in your party. And so it's like he's complaining about problems in the party that the party is literally addressing and has in many cases has already addressed before Trotsky even like brings them up.
Right. Yeah. Like in the last case, because just very briefly, in that situation at the 13th Party Congress, it was, I guess the trade unions, they had like a lot of complaints against the Soviet government. So the party reached out to the trade unions and they started this internal discussion on democracy. And it wasn't until October that Trotsky and then these other oppositionists, they began trying to capitalize on the situation. So it just shows maybe some of the more like opportunistic elements of how they were maneuvering at the time. But yeah, I think that was all really, really good. But as far as like next episode, you know, the country is going to start moving away from, they're going to talk more about moving from the NEP and what socialist development will be like. And really, they start having more of a broad discussion of, can socialist development even happen in the USSR? And that exposes further elements in the party that maybe shouldn't have been there. And, you know, they raise an opposition as well. So that's going to be where we talk about like socialism in one country versus permanent revolution. So we'll definitely get into more of the ideological aspect of as well, because we haven't really got to touch that too much so far.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. So, yeah, that's all for today's episode, folks. Stay tuned for part 3 of the Moscow Trials, talking all about Trotsky's day.
Peace.